Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia.
Dr. Lawyer, idiot chief. For my life with songs of grief, with the yellow fear and fearless eyes. Temper all the times I've tried.
Hello and welcome to Court Appointed. I am your co-host and future law student interested in all things legal and illegal, Riley Smurl.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl, and I am just her dad. Well, Riley, two things happened since our last podcast.
What's that?
Well, one was we had to recover from Charlie taking over everything.
Yes, that required some recovery period.
She is a force to be reckoned with.
Yes.
And then the other is our joint alma mater, Marshall University Thundering Herd, became the Division 1A National Soccer Champions of the world.
Yeah. Men's soccer champions.
Yeah, men's soccer champion.
Yeah. I guess we're a soccer school now.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll play European football.
Mm-hmm.
They call it football over there.
It makes more sense. They use their feet.
Yeah. We football use our hands more than we use our feet in our football.
Yeah, that doesn't make much sense.
So I guess ours is a misnomer.
It's what Americans tend to do, right? Just take things from other countries, even if they don't make sense over here. Well, make them worse. We took football and made it not even make sense. Why is it football?
I have to say I enjoy American football more, but I also enjoy being the national champion.
Yeah.
So I that was the first, I think, full soccer game I've ever watched, other than you all when you were little and you played in, you know, youth league soccer.
That doesn't really count.
Yeah.
I didn't really play soccer. I ran around.
And jumped in the puddles.
Yeah.
You ran in search of the puddles to jump in instead of the ball. The ball really was incidental to your soccer playing.
Well, I just didn't understand. I thought we were supposed to take turns. I thought they were going to, like, give it to me at some point, but I... No. Then they expected me to just go get it, and I didn't. I had no interest in that.
It's just like a lot of things in life. You got to reach out and take it.
Well,
nobody gives you nothing.
Well, I was like five, so.
I should have taught you to be more ruthless at that point.
But yeah, it was also the first and probably only full game of soccer I have ever and will ever watch, unless we make it to the national championships again next year.
Yeah, well, I may even watch if we're in the playoffs next year.
Oh, yeah, that too.
Yeah, I didn't know what to expect this year. This was a complete surprise to me.
And everyone else.
Yeah. But first unseeded team to ever win it.
Mm-hmm. The only national championship we've gotten any time recently.
That's right. Well, we won the football 1AA national championship in 92 and 96.
Well, I did say anytime recently. That's like 30 years ago.
It seems like the other day to me. And here's the amazing thing. Our 92 championship, that was our first other championship of anything else. The winning kick was made by a soccer player.
Of course. It's always the soccer players.
His brother was the kicker for our team, and his brother violated team rules the day before the championship game, so the coach suspended him for the game. So he was a backup kicker. He had never kicked anything but kickoffs, had never kicked a field goal in a collegiate football game. And he went out with very little time left on the clock and kicked the game-winning field goal.
Wow. What did his brother do? What rules did he break?
Well, he didn't make it back into his room for curfew.
Oh. Well, that's kind of a silly rule. But at least it turned out well.
That's right. It turned out to go down in lore, tie the soccer program with the football program.
Because that guy messed up. His brother got a chance to win a national championship.
Willie Merrick. That was his name.
The one that won it?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah, the one that won it. Willie Merrick.
Gotcha.
He was one for one in his collegiate career, and it was a championship kick.
That's all that matters then.
Guess so. Well, we didn't come to talk about Marshall's national championship, although we'd like to do that. But,
yeah.
But we're here instead to talk about a case that came to light the other day when I was perusing through my usual news sources.
Yahoo.
Yahoo, yeah.
As you often do.
Yeah.
Every morning.
Well, it was Yahoo for Yahoos, so that's me.
Mm-hmm.
But they were talking about this Somerton man. And that they were digging him up. This was May 19th, 2021.
That was just 2 days ago.
Yeah. And so they were...
One day ago.
Depends on when you listen to this.
Well, yeah.
Could be a week, might be a month, could be next
year. Could be next year, I don't know.
Yeah.
But from the time we're recording this.
Yeah, one day ago. But they had gotten a judge to finally order the body exhumed. Now, this was from the Somerton man was found dead on an Australian beach in 1948. And they have never been able to figure out who he was or who he might have been. There's been all kinds of rumors, anything from being a Russian spy to being a jilted lover, and everything in between. And there has always been speculation about this. It seems like they're always having these kind of things in Australia. I think I told you before about the prime minister that disappeared from there, like in the 70s.
He did
Harold
tell me
Holt.
About him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He just went down for a swim one day and disappeared. And they had all kinds of rumors about him, like Japanese submarines were waiting off the coast and they kidnapped him and took him and other things like that. And
man.
Went and lived another life, you know. So Australians, they have weird things happen at the beach. So
well, it's not just Australia. Wasn't there an American one where it was a guy who like stole a plane and there wasn't anyone else on it, but he was a con artist or a thief or something and he had a bunch of money and no one ever found him or the plane?
Well, now, I don't know about that. There was a D.B. Cooper story where he hijacked the plane and he jumped out of it with the money.
Oh, maybe that's what I'm thinking of. But yeah. They never found him.
Now, he let all the passengers go, just
yeah.
kept the crew. They gave
yeah,
him a suitcase
of.
Full of money. And then somewhere over, I don't know, somewhere out in the west, in the northwest, he jumped out of the back of the plane and disappeared into the night. And they never saw him again. They don't know if he was alive or dead. The only thing they ever found was some traces of the bills that he had with him. They did find one of those in a river at one point.
It's crazy.
That was like 1978
yeah.
or something like that.
Yeah. Always weird to me how people can just vanish. Especially national parks. Man, there are lots of people that just disappear in those things. So it's not just Australia.
Oh, okay.
We have people that just kind of vanish too.
Well, this
but
guy
not
didn't
unidentified
vanish. This guy
ones.
Appeared
he
dead
appeared,
on the beach.
Yeah, but no one knows who he is. Which, again, means somewhere someone just vanished. This guy.
From somewhere else.
From somewhere else.
He showed up dead in Australia.
Yeah.
Yeah, on the beach.
Maybe he came from somewhere else.
So
maybe he's American.
If you're traveling and you're a tourist on the beaches of Australia, keep an eye out.
For men? Dead
or
ones?
For you, I don't know, disappearing or washing up dead.
For you?
Keep an eye out for you washing up dead.
Okay.
Well, he actually didn't wash up because there were people that said they saw him the night before. And they saw him and they thought he was just drunk sitting down there on the beach. But when asked whether they saw him move or not, some said they thought so, he might have, they weren't real sure. But nobody thought to go down and shake him. And then later, when they really questioned these people further, and they looked at what was going on with the body, they said, well, this wasn't even the same guy they were looking at, so... There's been a lot of confusion, mm-hmm. and there's been a lot of mystery and intrigue that has surrounded this man since 1948.
Yeah. This is one of those cases that, to me, and I'm sure you have more details to go into, but whenever I look at cases from, like, several decades ago, it's wild how much police work has evolved. The things that they didn't do or did do when they first found this guy that now I feel like would have been, like, first steps, like the stuff they found on him that were weird clues about him, but they didn't really find them until months later, like I
right
don't know.
And of course DNA was not a thing then.
Right, they couldn't use that to find him or figure out who he was.
Right, they could only do so much. They did not have, I mean, let alone that they didn't have agencies within Australia connected to be able to compare information. They mm-hmm. didn't, you know, they certainly didn't have it internationally, although they did have the United States was given information to check on it with the secret, not the Secret Service, the CIA, and then also the Scotland Yard. Scotland Yard investigated it, and they could not find any satisfactory answers as well. So, I mean, you know, those are the big dogs.
Yeah.
It's often known as the Tamam Shud case, and that's that refers to a clue that was found that was a torn out part of a book that was, and I know I'll mess this name up, Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, and it was authored by the 12th century poet Omar Khayyam. And the this part in there was this language for "it is finished" or "it is the end."
Mm-hmm.
And that was found in the fob pocket of some pants in a suitcase that was later identified as belonging to him, that was at the train station checked into a locker.
Mm-hmm.
So they searched, put out a search wanting to know, because this was physically torn out of this book,
mm-hmm.
and put in a search for it. And this book was actually found that it came from. But the police never really released where they found it. It was rumored that it was found in the back seat of a car.
Yeah. And they, I also read that they, on the inside back cover of this book, they were able to read through indentations left from previous handwriting, like when you write on top of a piece of paper and can kind of scribble on top of it and see right. what was on top.
Mm-hmm.
They said they found a local telephone number, another unidentified number, and text that resembled an encrypted message, but they never deciphered or interpreted it in any way that they said was satisfying in their investigation of the case, whatever right. that means.
Well, they gave it to everybody, all the people from, you know, like after World War II, you had a lot of people that were worked on breaking codes,
mm-hmm.
and that's what they did. And they gave it to them, several different groups from different countries, and nobody could break what the encryption was. Now, it could have been, some people have said that these series of letters put together may have just been like some kind of prompter to himself, like the first letter of each word
mm-hmm.
that he was just memorizing for himself.
Right.
But no one has ever satisfactorily been able to answer it. Not only that, there's even disagreement about where this guy might have been from.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't even determine where he'd been from. They found an unused train ticket that he had missed that train that he had bought the ticket for because it had departed earlier in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And they also found a used bus ticket that he had used to come to the town.
Yeah. Said he came from either Melbourne, Sydney, or Port Augusta.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't know which one. Which is interesting to me that they can narrow it down to those three, but don't know much more beyond that. Can't figure out which one.
Well, I guess that bus came from all those places, and they don't know exactly where he boarded the bus
or something. Oh, I guess that makes sense. It makes sense.
Besides the bus ticket and the train ticket, it said that it also included a narrow aluminum cone, a half-empty packet of Juicy Fruit chewing gum, an Army Club cigarette packet, which contained 7 cigarettes of a different brand, Kinsitas, and a quarter full box of Bryant and May matches. Now, that was all that was on him. Of course, no ID or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, there were witnesses that came forth that said they saw him sleeping the day before, but none of those were able to pan it out. Said according to the pathologist, a guy named John Burton Cleland, the man was of Britisher appearance and thought to be aged 40 to 45 years old. He was in top physical condition. He was 5'11", with gray eyes and fair to ginger color hair, slightly gray around the temples, with broad shoulders and a narrow waist, hands and nails that showed no signs of manual labor. Oh, this was interesting. Big and little toes that met in a wedge shape, like those of a dancer or someone who wore boots with pointed toes, and pronounced high calf muscles, consistent with people who regularly wore boots or shoes with high heels or performed ballet. He was dressed in a white shirt, a red, white, and blue tie, brown trousers, socks, and shoes, a brown knitted pullover, and a fashionable gray and brown double-breasted jacket of reportedly American tailoring. All labels on his clothes had been removed, and he had no hat, which was unusual for 1948. He had no wallet, he was clean-shaven, and this led police to believe he had committed suicide. So, it's like, you know, you would get rid of everything that you had.
Right.
And then do that. They did think it was strange, though, that all the labels were cut out. However, there was a theory that in those days, you know, because the war had wreaked havoc on economies and stuff like that, that a lot of people were buying stuff secondhand. And most people had the habit of writing their name on the labels. So you didn't want somebody else's name on the labels of your clothes, because mm-hmm. then they know you're wearing secondhand clothes. So sometimes that was a common practice just to cut them out.
Yeah. Well, and this actually, that same idea came up again. I'm skipping ahead a little bit. I want to come back to when they first found his body. But they found, not until over a month later, they found a suitcase at the station that they thought belonged to him. Mm-hmm. And there was a bunch of stuff in it that we can talk about later. But one of the things in it were clothes, but all the identifying marks on the clothes had been removed. But police found the name T. Keene on a tie, on a laundry bag, and Keene spelled differently on a singlet. But they believe whoever removed the clothing tags either overlooked these three items or purposely left the Keene tags on the clothes, knowing it was not his name.
Right.
Which I guess was not unusual. Like, as you said, there was lots of rationing going on. You'd get other people's clothes.
Right.
So it's possible he had someone else's clothes.
So then maybe whoever did this left that as a red herring.
Yeah.
The T. Keene.
Right.
One of the things they noted that they thought was peculiar, while it had a couple of pairs of pants and four pairs of underwear, it noted, and a pair of pajamas, there were no additional socks in there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you would have had socks to wear along there. And it was also one of the pairs of pants had sand in the cuff
mm-hmm.
that was in there.
Yeah. But again, that wasn't until over a month later they found that suitcase and determined it was his, which I don't know exactly how they determined that. They just said they found it January 14th and he was found on December 1st. And it was believed the suitcase was owned by the man found on the beach. But, I mean, they didn't have fingerprints or ID or anything to tie it to him. So, no, I guess they just assumed.
They knew he had been at the train station.
Right.
Because he had purchased that ticket. So, that made sense. And then, I guess, the size of the clothes were the same size as what
sense.
He was wearing. And nobody else came forth to claim it.
Mm-hmm.
So, they kind of, you know, that's an assumption they made. They couldn't,
right.
you know, verify it for sure. But that was
that
an
makes
assumption
sense.
They made.
But back to you were talking about they found the body, they assumed he committed suicide, but they performed the autopsy, and the pathologist concluded it couldn't have been natural, but couldn't come to a definite conclusion about cause of death, thought it might be some sort of poison.
Right, but they
that
found no traces of poison
yeah.
in his system. But they talked about the body when they examined it, that the stomach was deeply congested. There was blood mixed with the food in his stomach. Both kidneys were congested. The liver contained a great excess of blood. The spleen was strikingly large, about three times normal size. And there was destruction of the center of the liver lobules revealed under the microscope. So something, they think, caused all that to take place. And it would most likely have been some type of a drug.
Yeah, the pathologist said some sort of barbiturate or a soluble hypnotic. I thought it was kind of, not funny, but just an interesting tidbit they included that his last meal was a pasty eaten 3 or 4 hours before his death.
Yeah.
Which would have been really late at night. They said his time of death was around 2 a.m., so he was eating some sort of pasty at about, 11 the night before. But they said that was not where the poison came from. So
right.
they couldn't find any traces of poison, but because that pasty was still in there, it
basically
didn't come from that.
Basically undigested, I guess,
right.
so they could examine that.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you read better than I did. As I was reading through, I just read that as a pastry.
Well, I think that is what a pasty is, but I think pasty is the non-American word. It's a British baked pastry.
Hmm.
So, yes, it is a pastry, but it's called a pasty.
Probably had meat in it. The British seem to put meat in their pastry a
Not
lot.
Not always.
Like meat pies and stuff.
Yeah, but not all of
them. I mean,
them.
We have chicken pot pies, but we
That's
don't
a meat pie.
Kinds. Well, I know it is a meat pie, but it's not exactly a meat pie.
Mm-hmm.
Well, before we get back to this case, I would like to request approaching the bench to pay for court costs.
Who is it?
Who is it, you said?
Who is it?
Who is it? The judge said, who is it? Who wants to approach this bench? I say I do. I want to approach for our good friend at June's Journey. We talked to you about June's Journey before. It's a downloadable app that you can play with hidden objects and a murder mystery and clues to follow to solve, just like the case we're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. Mystery just like this one. You play as June Parker, who's an amateur detective, investigating the mysterious death of her sister. Got to use those memory and logic skills like you were talking about. Find those hidden objects. Put your memory to the test. See if you can remember where they all were.
And you're building a neat, fancy house, too, as you
yes.
go.
Yes, yeah.
There's all kinds of little things to be doing to keep you busy. And my only problem is that I start playing and I forget to do work because I'm so busy playing this game. Because yeah. once it pulls me in, I've just got to keep going to get to the next level and find the next clue.
Yeah, I mean, I downloaded this game several weeks ago, and I have not stopped playing it at least once a day since. It's like part of my routine now, I think.
Well, and it's evidently it's a part of a lot of other people's routine because 30 million fans across the globe have joined June's journey and are working through the various chapters and the various mysteries because there's more than one. So don't think you can get to the end and that's it. You mm-hmm. can just keep going. There's more in store.
Thousands of intricate scenes and new chapters every week.
And it's free to download. And, you know, it's just something when you've got time to pass that it's a very entertaining and enjoyable game.
Yeah. And it also is one of those games that makes me feel like I'm still exercising my brain, even in my off time from school or not doing anything else. Still keeping my skills sharp, but having fun.
Because there's a memory portion of it, too, where yes. once you look for an object, it's not like you just find it once.
Mm-mm.
As each list comes up, as you keep moving through, and the same objects will repeat along with new ones.
Mm-hmm.
And the quicker you can recall where those ones that you'd already found before are, the more points you can accumulate as you move along.
Yeah. I'm really into getting those perfects on every one. Get them all in a row before your little bar runs out.
That's right. Can you get more coins and more lightning bolts so you mm-hmm. can keep moving along?
Yeah.
Well, as we said, download June's Journey free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play.
Join us and the other 30 million fans from across the globe and awaken your inner detective with June's Journey in downloading June's Journey free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play.
So go help June on her journey. Now, back to our case. One other thing I found interesting that they found in the suitcase was a thread card of Barber brand orange wax thread. That's an unusual type of thread. This is another way that they tied it to him. It's not available in Australia, but it was the same as what was used to repair the lining in a pocket of the trousers that the dead man was wearing.
Mm.
So that was a pretty good indicator, too.
Mm-hmm.
Now they searched for that T. Keen that was on the clothes.
Mm-hmm.
And a search concluded there was no T. Keen missing in any English-speaking country, and a nationwide circulation of the dry cleaning marks also proved fruitless. So they couldn't figure out where the dry cleaning had taken place.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, all that could be garnered from the suitcase was that the front gusset and feather stitching on a coat found in the case indicated it had been manufactured in the United States. The coat had not been imported, indicating the man had been to the United States or bought the coat from someone of similar size who had been.
Which, I would like to add, the way they phrase that, it doesn't really tell you much about this guy. It just tells you he either was in the U.S., which they already suggested from a few other things he had, they said were American, or he bought the coat from someone of similar size who had been. So either he knew someone who had at some point been to America, or he had at some point been to America. But it doesn't necessarily narrow down the search that much.
Yeah, when you add back in, or he could have bought it from somebody that went mm-hmm. there. Now, one of the things that I thought was very interesting is I don't know if this is still a thing in Australia. Maybe at some point we can look it up and find out. But if you don't, like if you're not a suspect or you're not the criminal,
mm-hmm.
you're just like a witness or person of interest or something like that, you can ask that your name be removed from all records of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, okay, so if you want to turn around like a cold case, you hear about cold case files,
mm-hmm.
they want to go back and interview everybody there. You wouldn't have the name of the person. They'd put down a pseudonym. It'd be like, that was Jane Doe. And that was what they would keep in the records. And it was not her real name, and it would not have been her number, and it would not have been her address, because they don't want to give any of that away.
Wow.
Because they were afraid they'd... Remember how we talked about the difference between UK laws and American laws as far as defamation
mm-hmm,
and stuff?
Mm-hmm.
Same type thing. They didn't want to, if this is something that might have hurt her reputation, they didn't want to hurt her reputation,
mm-hmm.
even though it would hinder the case. So, as we said, there was a telephone number that was found in the back of that book that they found the writing in.
Mm-hmm.
And it belonged to a nurse named Jessica Allen Jo Thompson. Now, she was born Jessie Harkness in the city suburb of Merrickville, New South Wales. And when she was interviewed by police, Thompson said that she did not know the dead man or why he would have her phone number and choose to visit her suburb on the night of his death. However, she also reported that at some time in late 1948, an unidentified man had attempted to visit her and asked a next-door neighbor about her. In his book on the case, a guy named Gary Feltus stated that when he interviewed Thompson, he found that she was either being evasive or she just did not wish to talk about it. But he believed that Thompson knew the Somerton man's identity. Now, Thompson's daughter, Kate, did an interview, a television interview in 2014 on 60 Minutes, and she said she believed that her mother knew the dead man.
Mm-hmm.
But the mother requested that police not keep a permanent record of her name or release her details to third parties, as it would be embarrassing and harmful to her reputation to be linked to such a case. The police agreed, and a decision that hampered later investigation was made to changed her name in the case files.
Wow.
Now, it said that, you know, they had made a plaster cast of his face,
mm-hmm.
so they would have it to, you know, do research, because you can't just keep the body laying around, right?
Sure.
So they did that, and it said when she was shown the plaster cast of the dead man, they said that she could not identify the person, but they also said her reaction upon seeing the cast had her completely taken aback to the point of giving the appearance that she was about to faint. In an interview years later, the technician who made the cast that was present to see the viewing noted that after looking at the bust, she immediately looked away and would not look at it again.
That seems suspicious.
It does, doesn't it?
It does. I also saw, I don't know if you saw this, that Canadian VR specialists mm-hmm. made a video, like an animated video, using the plaster cast of what they think this man looked like when he was alive,
mm-hmm.
Like of a real person, like, you know, how they can make those virtual reality
right.
images of real people, like holograms almost. They made this video of what they thought this guy looked like turning his head to the sides and how he would look actually talking and moving, to be a lot better tool than that plaster cast. It's very shocking to look at. That was just last year they made that too.
Now, there were several theories that said they thought he was a spy and that he was killed due to those circumstances. And there are at least two sites that are relatively close to Adelaide, where, of course, the beach that he was found on might have been an interest to spies. The Radium Hill Uranium Mine and the Woomera Test Range, an Anglo-Australian military research facility. The man's death also coincided with a reorganization of Australian security agencies, which would culminate the following year with the founding of the Australian Security Intelligence Organization. That would be followed by a crackdown on Soviet espionage in Australia, which was revealed by intercepts of Soviet communications under the Venona Project. Now, another theory concerns Alf Boxall, who was reportedly involved in intelligence work immediately after World War II. In a 1978 television interview, Stuart Littlemore asks, "Mr. Boxall, you had been working, hadn't you, in an intelligence unit before you met this young woman?" Talking about the woman, mm-hmm. Thomason, that wanted to not be identified.
Mm-hmm.
"Did you talk to her about it at all?" In reply, Boxall says no, and when asked if Harkness could have known, Boxall replies, "Not unless somebody else told her." When Littlemore suggests in the interview that there may have been an espionage connection to the dead man, Boxall replies, "It's quite a melodramatic thesis, isn't it?" Now, Boxall's Army service record suggested he served initially in the 4th Water Transport Company before being seconded to the North Australian Observer Unit. And it said that he climbed very quickly through the ranks. So, I don't know, there was some theory that he could have been involved, but it made me wonder, with the way that the guy's insides were so in bad shape,
mm-hmm.
that uranium mine, what if he had been spying around that? I'm not sure what radiation poisoning yeah. does, but wouldn't that mess up your insides?
Yeah. Although I will say, they didn't know whether he had been put there after he had died or whether that's where he had actually died. And the only thing they said was suspicious that made them think there were a few things, but the biggest thing that made them think he'd been moved there was that there was no evidence of vomiting anywhere. And they said based off his pathology, and that's one of the main results of poisoning, there was no vomit. His shoes had been recently polished. They thought maybe that whoever had intentionally poisoned him had polished off his shoes and cleaned that up and then put him there so that they couldn't use that, I guess, maybe to identify him or tell what kind of poison was in his system.
Well, especially if you were walking on a beach, your shoes wouldn't look freshly polished.
Right. And they said that he did not look like he had been walking around all day like people had suggested.
So he had thrown up and died somewhere else and then been placed there.
That's what it seems like.
What it appeared as.
Now, one of the coroners and investigators said that would make all the difficulties disappear if they were able to determine that he had been moved there. That there were lots of things that didn't make sense that if he had just died there. So.
Yeah, well, that's there was a case I was watching the other day, and it was the same type thing.
Mm-hmm.
They found the body and were operating under the assumption that's where the crime took place, and they couldn't find any evidence. So then they came across evidence that suggested that it had happened somewhere else. And
mm-hmm.
once they found the initial crime scene, they were able to put it together.
Right.
So that's a big thing. But through the years, a number of possible identifications have been proposed. And like one of these, it was somebody gave a possible identification as a fellow named E.C. Johnson that was about 45 of Arthur St. Painham. The following day, the said Mr. Johnson identified himself at a police station and said, "It wasn't me, I'm right here."
Well, that didn't work out.
And apparently that happened a lot of times. Somebody would be identified, they say, "I haven't seen this guy since then. He disappeared. I think it was probably him," or he's like, "I served in the army with a guy and he looked just like him. I think it's him."
Mm-hmm.
And then the guy would surface, or they'd find out that, you know, that this person died somewhere else. His mm-hmm. family would come forward and say, "No, it wasn't him. I was married to him for 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, something like that. But there have been a lot of people that have thought that that was that they had found him. By February of 1949, there had been 8 different positive identifications of the body, including 2 Darwin men who thought the body was a friend of theirs, and others who thought it was a missing station worker, and another that thought it was a worker from a steamship. So they none of these, though, ever panned out. In 2011, an Adelaide woman contacted a biological anthropologist, Macy Hindenburg, about an identification card. She had found this card of an H.C. Reynolds that she found in her father's possession. The card, a document issued in the United States to foreign seamen during World War I, was given to Hindenburg in October 2011 for comparison of the ID photograph to that of the Somerton man. While Hindenburg found anatomical similarities in features such as the nose, lip, and eyes, he believed they were not as reliable as the close similarity of the ear. The ear shape shared by both men were a very good match. That's in parentheses.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. Although Hindenburg also found what he called a unique identifier, a mole on the cheek that was the same shape and in the same position in both photographs. Together with the similarity of the ear characteristics, this mole in a forensic case would allow me to make a rare statement positively identifying the Somerton man. So it said this H.C. Reynolds declared his nationality as being British and aged as 18. Now, that was in World War I.
Right, so it would have been before his body was found.
Right.
Well before.
Yeah. Searches conducted by the U.S. Naval Archives, the U.K. National Archives, and the Australian War Memorial Research Center have failed to find any records relating to an H.C. Reynolds.
Well, that makes me think it's fake.
Yeah, so they couldn't prove that this guy ever even existed. The South Australian Police Major Crime Branch, who still have the case listed as open, will investigate this new information. Some independent researchers believe the ID card belonged to one Horace Charles Reynolds, a Tasmanian man who died in 1953 and therefore could not have been the Somerton man.
Hmm.
So there's a lot of, you see on some of these shows where these armchair sleuths
mm-hmm.
They all get on the internet together and start solving it, like the suitcase murder things.
Yeah.
And they all get on there and start trying to solve it. So that's been happening with this.
Mm-hmm.
There's a site you can go to, and they're all sharing information and trying to make identifications and tracking down possible leads and all that kind of stuff.
I would like to say this is my theory that just recently surfaced and had become a topic of discussion right before they decided to exhume the body, which is why you'd seen this, because they decided to do that yesterday. This was from just 3 years ago. This is what I believe seems most likely, but I guess anything could have happened. The woman they found, whose number was in the back of this book, mm-hmm. had a son who was born in 1946, and his name was Robin. And he had two distinctive facial features. One was an oddly shaped ear that mm-hmm. they said was very similar to the Somerton man, and two missing incisors that left his canine teeth right next to his two front teeth, which also was a trait that belonged to the Somerton man. And Robin Thompson was a dancer in the Australian Ballet, giving him strong calves. And they said that also, that muscle structure was found mm-hmm. in the Somerton man. This man, this son of that woman, she never identified his biological father. And he died in 2009, but his ex-wife and his daughter, Rachel, both were alive in 2017. And this investigator wrote a letter asking if she knew anyone who might resemble the Somerton man, asking his ex-wife. And she said, well, yeah, that looks just like my ex-husband. So his granddaughter, Rachel, and his ex-wife both offer, or his granddaughter, Rachel, offered up DNA and, you know, said, here, I'm putting it into a genealogy database, like a 23andMe or an Ancestry, mm-hmm. because they would say, well, she would have inherited a quarter of her DNA from the Somerton man if this is his granddaughter. Mm-hmm. So they traced her genealogy and found it traced back to her paternal line, traced back to the mid-Atlantic states of the U.S., centered around Virginia. And they also said they see traces of Native American ancestry and chromosomes linked to relatives of Thomas Jefferson. So they're saying if this is true, and if Rachel is actually his biological granddaughter, that would put his ancestry in America, which would make some sense with some of the things they found on him. But I don't know. Seems like there's too many coincidences. Looking at the picture of this guy that she says isn't his son, but looks like it really could be.
Well, I think that's what's culminating here with why they exhumed the body a couple days ago.
Yes, that's why they said they couldn't determine whether or not she actually is his granddaughter, because they would have to exhume the body to get DNA to do that.
Right. They had hairs that were in the plaster cast that actually came from the dead body, and mm-hmm. they were using those, but I think that they could get better DNA from the bones themselves. And they have said that they took extreme measures to be careful in exhuming the body to make sure everything stayed intact, and that they felt that it was a very good specimen. So, of course, they just did this on the 19th, so they haven't right. gotten any data on it yet, but they're working on it. But they said that that Thomason's father had died in 1995 and the mother in 2007, and she suggested that her mother and the Somerton man may have been spies, noting that Jessica Thompson taught English to migrants and was interested in communism and could speak Russian, although she would not disclose to her daughter where she had learned it or why.
Interesting.
Yeah, and that's that same woman that they say
may have had a son with him.
Son named Robin, mm-hmm. yeah. Yeah. So they haven't answered all the questions yet, of course, but I find it interesting that this is a guy they just found dead. Nobody knew him. Nobody's missed him. But they found him dead in 1948. And they're still working on the case.
Yeah.
And they still found enough value in it where they wanted to exhume the body and examine it more. And
73 years later.
Yeah. And the judge that granted the exhumation said, this is more than just an unsolved case. This is somebody's father, husband, mm-hmm. son, brother, you know, something. And we want to bring some closure to people that wonder, somebody that wonders whatever happened to them.
Yeah.
And, you know, 1948, you're in Australia, you came from America, and you died over there. What kind of communications was there if you had no ID for anybody to say, hey, is anybody missing over there? Hey, right. y'all in America, anybody missing? We got somebody extra over here, and we don't know who he is.
Yeah, that didn't exist.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's going to bring us to
Legal Briefs.
Legal Briefs is a part of the show where Riley asks me questions, or I ask her questions, or when Charlie's here, Charlie asks us questions.
Yeah.
Charlie's not here this time, though, so
right.
it's good. So we won't have to know what that queen was turned into that she talked about. Remember, I said, what did it get turned into? It was a lizard, but I forget who it was.
Oh, that was from Descendants. It was Mal.
Mal?
Yeah.
Got turned into a lizard.
Well, no, Maleficent got turned into a lizard.
Oh, that's
Mal
right.
is her daughter.
Mal did it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the lizard was in there somewhere.
I have a question for you that is very central to this case. That is, what was the phrase they found on the scrap of paper, and what did it mean in his pocket?
It was Tommen.
You're cheating.
Yeah, I'm looking. Tommen suit offer or something. Tommen should.
Yes.
Tommen should. And it meant it is finished or it is the end. Something to the effect, depends on how you interpret it, because it's from a different language. And,
right.
You know, just like when you straight interpret like American from something else or English, as you could call it. You could call it English as well.
It is English.
Yeah,
that's. You should call it English.
In other languages, it's funny, the translations sometimes. We see that when we're watching TV and mm-hmm. we've got the subtitles up there.
Yeah.
And the straight translation is funny sometimes.
And what was the thing they found in his suitcase that they said was an unusual item not found in Australia that linked the suitcase to the clothes he was wearing?
It was a wax thread. An orange wax thread
yep.
that they found that was not made in Australia, and it was used to repair the pocket in his pants.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
So, what two items did he have in his pocket that would have appeared to have come from America?
A U.S. manufactured comb. Is that one of them?
Right.
And, there were lots of other things, but was the other one that was probably American, the Army Club cigarette pack?
Well, it didn't really say what Army, but I thought the half-empty packet of Juicy Fruit chewing gum.
Well, Juicy Fruit was probably around in other countries.
I don't know. I think that's an American thing. I mean, Jimmy Buffett sings about it.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it started in America, but it probably existed in other countries.
But in 1948, do you think they were selling that internationally?
I don't know. Oh, and it's not Army Club cigarette packet, because that was a British brand of cigarettes.
Huh.
So,
well, there you go.
That's British.
The Juicy Fruit is what struck me, that it was...
Yeah.
Even if they sold it over there...
I guess that's
probably
fair.
Came from America. It was an import. I'm pretty sure Juicy Fruit is an American-made product, although probably not anymore. It's probably made in China, because everything else is.
Yeah. Although this British cigarette packet contained 7 cigarettes that were a Scottish brand, so...
Is that what Kinsitas is?
Yes.
Kinsitas.
So, he was just trying to throw everybody off.
Yeah, Bryant and May matches. Those are probably somewhere else.
Yeah.
You just never know. You know, these people that die mysteriously, they just don't cooperate.
Their original factory was in London, and they later opened ones in the UK and Australia, so...
Hmm. Well,
no clue.
That's what they said. They've said that they identified his dressing as a Britisher, as they put it.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, a lot of the things that he had traced him back to America.
Yeah.
So it's really confusing.
Very confusing.
But with this DNA and this recent exhumation,
maybe we'll figure it out.
We may soon know an answer.
Mm-hmm.
Will the real Somerton man please stand up?
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Dr. Lawyer Indian Chief.
We're proud to be coming to you almost live from Smurl Studios, high atop Three Last Mountain.
And we want to thank Audio Boom for being a part of their network.
And we also want to thank the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for helping give us our start. Their podcasts include Bim Bam, Sawbones, Still Buffering, and many other fine offerings.
If you have the chance, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you liked us. And if you didn't, don't bother.
You're not supposed to say that.
You're going to edit that out, though, aren't you?
Why? You never did.
Thanks for listening. This has been Court Appointed. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude. Hello, and welcome to Tommy's Random Thought. Today's random thought is mask confusion. This whole pandemic thing has caused us to go through something that I don't think we will fully absorb and understand for quite a while. Looking at how TV shows have woven masks into their storylines and how inconsistent they are due to dramatic and artistic reasons, it made me think about our current situation. 2 years ago, I could not have imagined any situation where the American people would all be wearing masks. Then in the midst of this pandemic, I wondered if masks would just become a part of our lives from now on, and we would tell future generations how we used to live a mask-free life until COVID-19. But now the CDC has come out and said anyone vaccinated, inside or out, does not need a mask. This does make sense. I mean, the vaccine is supposed to make us immune or else at least keep us from getting sick or dying, even if we do have a breakthrough infection. Of course, there is no way to know who is vaccinated and who isn't. A lot of people who aren't vaccinated have been running around without masks for a while, so we have no way of knowing who is or who isn't. My question is, at this point, who cares? Look, the truth is, if you wanted to be vaccinated, you would be by now. If you don't, you probably aren't going to change your mind. I don't see why we should beg you or offer you incentives to not be a dumbass. Just be one. You've heard the Carrie Underwood song, Let Jesus Take the Wheel. I say we just drop the push and sing, Let Darwin Take the Wheel. Now, certainly the exception to this is kids. They should all wear masks until their vaccination has been okayed and they have a chance to get their protection. But the truth is, the CDC has not been worried about kids from the beginning. They were willing to let them go to in-person classes because they had such a low spread factor amongst other kids. It also seemed the younger the kids, the quicker their immune systems kicked in and fought off this virus. So kids have never really been a major concern in this entire struggle. It has mostly been older people and those with underlying conditions. In West Virginia, I would estimate that 90% of those who died from COVID were 55 and above. As far as kids, we maybe had one or two that I recall. Now, don't get me wrong, even one is too many. But I am just saying that from a statistical standpoint, this has not been a disease of the young, like, say, polio was. While I don't think that we have reached herd immunity, we have reached the point of whoever is willing to get vaccinated has gotten vaccinated. So forget about all the exceptions. I don't want to hear any more except for public transit or federal buildings or indoor gatherings of large crowds. Either we're safe or we aren't. Those that aren't will just have to deal with whatever happens. They say God protects the drunks and the fools, so maybe most of them will be okay. So except for kids under 12, let's just forget masks. We don't know who is vaccinated and who isn't, and there are too many conflicting situations that will only lead to trouble and more confrontation. So Darwin, take the wheel. This has been Tommy's Random Thought.